The Spring Gap is this week, and 69. But we hope you pretend we're football for the next hour. I'm your host, Will Baser, and I'm joined alongside by Johnny Brashear and Timothy Preston, as always. You guys should listen to the Hornscast channel, where you can find any of your Longhorn podcasting needs and wants. We're going to be talking about Texas winning the National Invitational Tournament Championship this past week against Lipscomb, and what we thought about, do a post-mortem on the season, give you our thoughts on what Shaka did this year, and talk about questions heading the next offseason. So, let's get into it, y'all. We'll start off, as we always do, with pretend you're getting to know us. And as we record, it is the national championship with Tech versus Virginia. So we have to do our one shining moments of the year, of our lives, really. And then we'll climax together with...
Hello.
it's a sweet
now pain. I'm paying attention. All right.
With the... our favorite part of our show, after we've been doing it, what, 3 years now? Of the 3 years, what has been our favorite part of the show? And that will be the part where it goes, one shining moment, the very end, and they're holding up a trophy and whatnot. Yeah, that'll be our one shining moment. So, y'all ready? Tim, you want to start us off here with your,
sure,
your two-second clip?
So, my one shining moment is a little bit the opposite of perhaps what a shining moment should be. I think the best player I ever played against in basketball when I was in high school was a guy named Kirk Heinrich, who played at Sioux
City. Never
heard
of him.
Yeah. He played at a high school in Sioux City. They went to Kansas and played, I think, for the Bulls and a lot of the teams, I think. I don't remember exactly who I played for. But in high school, I played against him. And I remember the very first time that I played against him, I was dribbling the ball at half court, and he could obviously tell I was not the kind of basketball player that he was. And he was a tremendous defender at that level because he's super fast. And I was dribbling the ball at half court, and I kind of, like, I knew the play. I can't even blame it on my coach. But I didn't have to, like, to look over and get the play from the coach. He stole the ball from me, whoop. Just like quickly put his hand in there, stole the ball, and went down and two-hand jammed it.
So in your
later on in
clip, you're not the main character in your own 2 second clip.
No, I am not.
there I am, Mom. Look, I'm on TV.
Yep. And so we went back as we did every game, and we watched the clip. And, we watched the whole game, of course, and we got to the point I knew it was coming. but I didn't really know what I did. So Heinrich steals the ball, and I don't do anything. Like, I don't try to go after him. I just sort of, like, put my head down in shame and clap my hands together. Kind of standing at half court looking very desolate and melancholy as he goes down and just throws it down really hard. So mine would probably be more like a quarter of a second or maybe three quarters of a second where you see me in just desolation, like hang my head and clap my hands as he goes down and euphorically slams the ball.
I can totally see it. It's one where, like, you're in the foreground and he's in the background and you're just looking down at the ground walking away. It's one of those where,
one,
you know,
shiny moment.
The 2 second clip is of the guy crying.
I've thought it would be a 2 second clip of Tim on the bench in the second half.
I like that one. That's a good one.
Well, when you're dating the coach's daughter, you've got some options. Oh, let's go.
Johnny?
All right, so my one shining moment is going to be, I mean, they're all
one
in slow motion, so this feels
moment.
Really redundant. Thank you, Tim. Is a slow-mo sequence of me at home realizing that I bought the wrong size part at Home Depot and I know I have to go back.
No, it's like, it's you coming home, right? And you,
no,
you...
I'm already home.
Okay.
I'm
okay.
Like, I'm at, you know, like fixing the toilet or something, and I'm at the toilet and I realize that I got like a 3/8 inch nut instead of a 1/4 inch or whatever. And I know I got to go back for this one goddamn nut.
And holding and so, the two of them up together and see the broken one is different size than the one you have and just kinda...
Yeah, just that 2 seconds of me, just that realization sort of like the kid from Simpsons when Lisa broke his heart, you know, he kind of slowed down frame by frame and just you just see me like
where his heart
crushing. Yeah, exactly.
Yep, there it is. That's when his heart split in two.
Yeah, that's my one shining moment.
I love it. I think my one shining moment, I don't even know if this is really from my life, but I, as soon as Tim was talking about this, because he came up with the idea, I immediately thought of Full House and just corny sitcom where you turn and look at the camera and you do the wave and you're just like, yeah, sure. like, oh, you caught me tying my shoe. Like starring Will Baser.
I always go to that little blonde kid at the computer who's like nodding his head. And then turns over and gives a thumbs up or whatever.
A thumbs up, yeah.
Exactly. I turn around, like untying my shoe, and I look up, and I give a thumbs up. One shining moment.
Do-do-do. So,
yeah, sitcom Will. That was a terribly delivered joke, but Tim, what is your what's your climax? How did you climax?
Oh, over the entire course of our show?
No, I mean in bed, but I mean, sure, we'll go that way.
Yes. So my very favorite, what I kind of feel like I do with this podcast, I think that my role is kind of probably a little bit three part. Like I try to do some like breaking down of play stuff as far as like understanding some of the nuanced pieces of the game. I also feel like I kind of bring that coaching aspect as far as like, you know, like I'm an active coach.
But where he's most comfortable is all up in your fucking face.
Yeah, exactly. But I think for me, what I try mostly to do is to be the voice of reason. And I know that I'm often a very optimistic person. That's just kind of my nature. But I try to be optimistic in a reasonable, pragmatic way. And last year, you two buttfuckers... when Trae Young was on his obviously masterful run, and you guys both were like, well, we're going to lose every game against Oklahoma because Trae Young is the greatest player that's ever lived. And of course he was on a masterful run of like being awesome. But I knew at that moment, like, okay, well, there's one of two options here.
All right, were we Muppets in this? I'm just
no,
curious.
The, yeah, go
I'm
back
also,
and look
I'm
at,
also curious as to where the one shining moment is going to come, like where,
oh, no,
where
I know where this
the picture
is going
here, Tim?
Yeah. This
well,
is
it
not
was
a,
just,
yeah.
No, it There's was no just simply here. The fact that I, as you guys were both, you know, both essentially making it sound as if like, no, he's the greatest player that's ever lived. And like, that's all that could possibly be for the rest of the season. I was like, well, he's very good. There's a pretty decent chance that he's not the greatest player that's ever lived. So, let's see how it kind of plays out. And so mine would just be like that Robert Redford, like on the motorcycle, just kind of nodding slowly. So kind of like
with us crying in the background or something.
True. Well, I don't. There needs to be no context of that. My happiness is all on the inside, and just sort of like his next, like just a slow nod. That in real time was like, I don't know, probably about, well, at least a month and 3/4 as he kind of struggled through sort of the rest of his season. But you can speed it up to a couple seconds or just like take a little snippet of that.
So his entire season of struggling with you on a motorcycle just nodding and it's in 2 seconds.
Yes.
Okay.
Just picking the highlight, like whatever smile and nod was best of that month and a half stretch where he struggled towards the end of the season.
Okay. Johnny?
Yeah, my favorite moment was when I banged Tim's wife.
Well, she needs some kind of loving. Everyone deserves it.
I had a nice, like, friendly, like, well, I enjoy these discussions kind of thing. And then Tim decided to scoreboard. So, fuck it. This is how this goes. You say some shit, I fuck your wife. That's how this works. I'm booking a ticket on Expedia right now. This is gonna happen.
Talk shit, get cucked. What?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. Who's the beta now? No. So my favorite moment, which feels sort of quaintly earnest now, is I like our 30-10 discussions. I like when we have to have those discussions of when we're deciding, you know, when we talk about what's coming into the season or what's going into next season, who gets 30 minutes, who gets 10, because it kind of puts us to a test of who we really think is going to be good, who we don't think is going to be, you know, as productive or whatever. And I like the discussions that result from that. So that's mine. It's really weird being the wholesome one here. So
I like those two.
Will, could you take this over? I don't know how to end a wholesome note.
No, not yet, because I want to know what's the picture. What are we looking at here? What's the 2 seconds of that holding up the trophy for Johnny, but in 30-10 time?
I mean, I guess is the trophy Tim's wife? Because okay. I'll hold that up. Yeah, I don't know.
With a subtext under it. So he's holding up his wife with subtext just saying, I really enjoy 30-10 talks.
Yeah. Well, you can be like, Tim thought Liddell was going to get 30 minutes. So.
Yeah, no, I'll just, no, the 2 seconds will be when I fuck Tim's wife, because that's as long as it's going to take. Honestly, I'm not that great at it. I'm really not that good at it. It's like, it's going to be disappointing for everybody. I ruined a relationship for just literally a moment's glory, and that's it.
How glorious it was. How glorious.
Yeah.
Yeah, Johnny, I gave you, what, literally 5 seconds left. 5 seconds more and you ruined your wholesome moment. So
thank you. You're welcome. I feel much more at home now. So
yeah,
thank you.
No, it kind of goes with my one shining moment of
you also fucked Tim's wife.
No, there are multiple moments that have been like that in the show, but also there have been multiple moments where, and I really can't decide if it was the show where Johnny got to lead us in and I had to take it out because he immediately started off with, and that's how you got chlamydia. But we hope you pretend we're football. And then just Tim and I are just like with hands in face and just, God damn it, Johnny. And Johnny's just in his corner just laughing. Or the one time where Johnny was talking about his dead cat and Tim and I were on the side just like, what the fuck is wrong with you, Johnny? So it's one of those two moments where Johnny is just super proud of himself for just being fucking Johnny Brashear, and Tim and I with looks of disgust and surprise and also, you know, finding it fucking hilarious on the other two sides of the screen. That would be my one shining moment.
People being horrified yet amused is probably going to be on my tombstone.
Mortified but amused. You're right. And it's going to, as it ends, like, you know, it fades out and just kind of zooms in on Johnny's like self-satisfied face.
inside the tomb, like, yes. Inside the coffin.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
They're just a smiling skull.
All right. But, y'all, the one shining moment for Texas happened this year. The NIT, Texas is National Invitational Tournament champions of this season. Let's go ahead and break down the Lipscomb game, because we've broken down all the other ones. But there's no real separation of these two topics, Lipscomb and the importance of winning a championship for Shaka Smart and this Texas team after the year they had. Can y'all break down what that importance really is for this program?
No, I don't know that we can. I'm not certain that you can.
Great. All right.
Thanks, everybody. See you next season.
Yeah, exactly. 1, 2, 3.
off to a great start this show.
Yeah. I would think anybody, when you're talking about something like the NIT, you're talking about, I mean, it feels like every single column I've written in the last 3 weeks has started with the same caveat. It's not the tournament we wanted to be in. This is not where Texas wanted to be. This isn't where TCU wanted to be either. This isn't where, you know, like name the school. They're not excited about the NIT. And it's felt like that has been like the overhanging gloom over what has otherwise been a really fantastic couple weeks for Texas.
But look at it this way, it's better than the CBI.
Yeah, it certainly is.
Much better.
And like there's one other tournament too. I don't remember for sure what it is. Like there's the four.
Really?
CIT.
What?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah, there's a CIT. That's what West Virginia was in, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. They were playing South Florida, I want to say, in the finals.
Yeah, didn't they lose to, like, Coastal Carolina or something? Let me look that up.
There's
I look
more
that up.
Than two? Okay, well.
Yeah, there's four.
There's four, and, four, like invitational tournaments. So when
they lost to Coastal Carolina. That's exactly who they lost. They gave up 109 points to Coastal Carolina.
Wow.
Whew.
At home.
So when you... When I think about what comes off of the NIT, there's going to be some positivity. There's going to be, just like that aura of happiness that I can imagine being around the program over the next couple of months, which is really big, right? And that's something that as a coach I can kind of speak to a little bit of, like, even if you don't have the ultimate season, like there are ways to end your season that can really energize you. And I would imagine that will be true for this Texas program because there's plenty of guys coming back. There's a lot of things I feel like they're playing for. They've got a nice recruiting class coming in. But if you want to sum up, the NIT kind of in general, I don't know if I'd say bittersweet, but I think you have to acknowledge the fact that even though it was a really positive five-game stretch for them, like there's that caveat. There's always that caveat with that. So I think it was. I think from the tournament standpoint in general, that was, great, but really, really good, but, the best we played over a 5-game stretch, but.
But so also, Texas hasn't ended off a season with a win.
In a long time.
So it's the last time they won the NIT?
Yeah.
Because they didn't win the last game. I think they lost to Iowa State at Iowa State the year Penders got fired. And then when Barnes didn't make the tournament, it was...
That was the CBI year.
Yeah.
And there was also, on top of that, them not winning games in the Big 12 tournament when they don't make any of the tournaments.
Right.
So,
right, exactly.
Again, this is pretty rare and something to be
second
celebrated.
Second time in my lifetime.
Johnny?
Yeah, I mean, there are only four teams that end the season with a win because everybody else either loses in their conference tournament or in one of the other tournaments. So it is unique. It's a unique situation. I would maybe hedge against refute the 69th best team just because I don't think anybody can really say that the 14, 15, 16 seeds in the NCAA tournament were better than Texas. That's sort of a ludicrous proposition. But nonetheless, I agree with what Tim said about it being... I mean, there is this giant caveat there. There is a giant asterisk to it of this is obviously not the tournament they wanted to be in. It was a disappointing season... If for no other reason than what tournament they ended up in. Having said that, it's been a long time since I have seen a Texas team play this well for 5 games in a row. It's been a long time since I've seen a Texas team end the season playing their best basketball.
Mm-hmm.
So
that's a big one.
You can look at it a number of different ways, and there's a lot of legitimate pros and cons to how this season ended. There are legitimate questions to what the longer trajectory of this program is, based on where it sits now. But I feel like if for no other reason than a significant chunk of the Texas players, maybe all of them actually, experienced postseason success for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
That's valid and that's valuable. It can show them what they need to do on a consistent basis. Whether they execute on that or capitalize on that remains to be seen. And that's something we'll find out next year. But I mean, when was the last? It's been 10 years at least since Texas made it to the second weekend of the NCAA tournament. So,
yeah, 08.
Yeah, none of these players and nobody in this coaching staff, on this coaching staff, at least at Texas, has experienced a run in a tournament at Texas. So maybe these guys finally get some sort of glimpse into what it means for, they kind of see the payoff. They understand the why of the thing. It's one thing to be told you need to play like this, you need to practice like this every single day. It's another thing to say you see what just happened and what resulted from you doing all of these things. That it can kind of crystallize it for people. So hopefully the players get to learn from this and get to apply it forward.
I agree. And I think when we've seen Texas with all these first round flameouts, I mean, so we won a first round game against Arizona State. Before that, they won a first round game against Oakland.
Been a really long time. Been a really long time.
But I mean, but otherwise, I mean, every, like, since 09, well, no, they beat someone before they played Duke. Anyways, so since 08, they've only won three tournament games in the NCAA tournament, right? I don't remember who they won before they lost to Duke when Varez Ward almost kind of pulled us all the way through.
They beat Minnesota.
Okay, yeah. Actually, I was going to say that. So let's say they beat TCU senior night, and we get into the tournament, right? Like we've sort of seen over the last few years, they squeak in. They're probably an 11 seed. But they're there and, you know, whatever validation that they needed, that they are a good team, happens, right? So if they need validation, they get that validation. Do they play with that same sense of urgency that they did in the NIT? I don't know if they do. Like, if they get that validation that, hey, we are a good team, people believe in us, we've done enough, you know, even though our record's not what we want it to be, we've shown some things that prove, hey, we belong in this discussion. But I think there's just as much reason to think that slight, that, nah, man, we don't believe in you, we don't think you're as good as you guys think you are, might have been a catalyst. Like, that could well be the harbinger for this team saying, oh, well, maybe we need to really buckle down. Maybe we need to get to work. And as Johnny says, if that is their chance to look at who they are as a program and say, all right, now we're ready to rock and roll. Now we truly understand the amount of work it takes. Now we understand the energy that you have to bring. Now we understand the preparation level that it's going to take. And, you know, if the coaching staff has been saying, like, we need this, we need this, we need this, and finally they're getting it because they felt that slight, I mean, it could be the best thing for them, even with as well as Kerwin and Dylan played, and they're going to be gone next year. But, you know, there's so many questions. Like, I don't know. Maybe that caveat works the other way. Maybe if they go to the NCAA tournament, like, oh, well, it was nice to go to the NCAA tournament, but because they went there again, there's that sense of, well, we don't need to change anything because we're already a tournament team. You know, like, all those moving pieces. And I do like Johnny's idea as well. Like, okay, like, this success begets success. And if they have this, you know, this nice run, maybe that's going to kind of carry over. Like, hey, we're a winning team in March. That's what we do. It's who we are. So I mean, it's all conjecture, but there are plenty of pieces of silver lining that can be found there.
Can I say how really sad this is that we're talking about this while Tech is in the national championship? Just
yeah, I sure hope they lose.
Maybe we'll be good next year while we watch Texas Tech in the national championship. But I have to bring it back, and I think this is the fourth show in a row that I'm doing this, to the parallel nature of Texas's 2017 postseason success in football, even though it was kind of a hollow success, and this one, which is also some success but kind of hollow.
You mean when they beat Arkansas or Missouri?
Yeah, when they beat Missouri in the Texas Bowl.
Well, I mean, I guess what I'd say is it really just it, just like it was for the football team, it is dependent upon the basketball team to capitalize on this and to use this. Like, you go back and look at the
and have their luck turn around, which is what happened really for the football team.
Well, I mean, yeah, well, they, but some of yeah. that is like some of luck is I don't want to talk about luck so much just because outside of Andrew Jones, a lot of this luck variance, especially if you look at Pomeroy, is I look at it less as, you know, sort of the stereotypical luck and more of a team that is underperforming for various reasons. But what I was trying to get to is that the past record of NIT champions over the past, you know, 10 plus years is very sketchy. It does not necessarily portend a future of success or some great leap. There have been a couple teams like TCU went, you know, to the NCAA tournament the year after they won the NIT. I think they were a sixth seed that year. There's things like that, but there's also just as many teams who didn't do anything the next year. So, just as it was, the football team needed to take that, internalize it and say, okay, this is what we need to do every single day to make that next step or make the next two steps. That the basketball team has to do that as well. And that's on players and coaches. They need to, the players need to understand the amount of work and the amount of energy they put into the games, the amount of execution that they, you know, that they successfully put forward on the court. The coaches need to look at themselves in the mirror very strongly and very sternly and say, what if anything did we do differently in these last five games? And is it something that we can project forward?
Let's go ahead and take this game right here. And what exactly did stand out about the Lipscomb game in the tournament in general for you watching this Texas team perform?
Defensive energy to me was the very first thing that I thought that we did a good job on. You listen to Shaka before just about every game or in his post game stuff or even the halftime show, like halftime quick interviews. It almost always goes back to hey, we got to play better defensively. We got to get our hands on more deflections. We have to kind of run around and bring that energy. And Rick used to say that too. Like no matter how bad they looked on offense under Rick, it was always defense. And like I get that. He's right. Certainly, you know, the better you play defensively, it can help you offensively. What I thought was important about this stretch was I do think this team actually did really need to dial in defensively more. Like they needed to show more urgency and close out faster and play with more anticipation as far as their rebounding, you know, and kind of play, especially on the perimeter, with a lot more intensity on the best shooters. Against Lipscomb, they like the combination of Ramey in the first half and Roach in the second half absolutely shut down Matthews. Like he was, I mean, we talked about him a decent amount in the pregame podcast we did last week, where he had scored 78 points in two games, and he ended up, I think he was in double figures because he had so many free throw shots.
Yep.
But otherwise, like he was like 2 for 9 or something like that, or whatever it was.
Yeah, y'all told me he was good.
But I thought Ramey was everywhere. And even though Courtney didn't have a great game offensively because of, you know, he obviously did his job. And that's the kind of thing we haven't seen Texas really been able to shut some of those guys down over their time frames the last couple of years. And to see them do that was good. And it goes back to, I don't know that I've seen Texas fly around like they did in this whole five game stretch, but particularly against Lipscomb. Like they have. Again, we'll talk about it for a second time. That is what I think it was Seth Greenberg said, half court havoc. I mean, it wasn't a full court press. It wasn't like, you know, the double fist, the diamond or the, you know, the double fist pressed. But it was a ton of energy and a lot of movement on defense.
If they had played defense like that, in the last month of the regular season, they would have easily made the tournament. And, you know, maybe it's one of the great ironies of the Shaka Smart tenure that he he finally gets the offense going in 1 year and the defense craters. The guy's calling card has been defense. He has had good defenses here every single season. But it took a significant step back in the last half of the regular season, particularly in February. And they really turned it on in the NIT. They played a really good defense for the most part. There were some issues against Xavier that were sort of just, the size of Xavier posed unique problems for Texas. But generally speaking,
about 25 minutes against South Dakota State. But yeah.
I mean, you'd say maybe starting in the second half of Xavier, the last 3.5 games, they just really played good defense for the vast majority of the games. So again, it's what is it that they did in those 2 to 3 games that they weren't doing before? What was it that allowed them to have that energy that they didn't have before? Is it a matter of just fatigue over the season that they started to slow down? Is it a matter of the lineups being enough different that they were able to play, better defense? There's a lot of questions there that we could delve into.
I think it has a lot to do with the lineup, and I brought this up the last time where Osakowski was put in a position where this year he was the rebounder because Jackson Hayes was not. And without Jackson Hayes on the floor, he kind of went back to his natural position, which allowed him to do what he was really built to do more this year, slimming down and becoming not the guy who was he was last year, which was a rebounder. That was supposed to be Hayes, Sims, and Hepa's jobs this year, but it was tasked with Osakowski because that's what he had, and he had to be the guy under the basket doing the short shots, which we found not his strong suit. So it created a lot of problems for him, which he was relieved of during this tournament, which is why he had, and also Curran Roach had, a great tournament.
Well, and I mean, I would say that some of it is that Osakowski very clearly understood that the end of his college career was going to happen any game now, and he played like a guy who was not going to leave anything in the tank. Mm-hmm. And that's to his credit. Like, he had a very good tournament. There was a stat I read by a guy named Christian Corona who said that when he was referencing the last game of the game against Lipscomb, he said that Osakowski became the only player this decade with as many points and rebounds that he had 19-11 with 5+ assists, 3+ three pointers, and 0 turnovers. He's the only guy in the last decade that did that with his sort of offensive production. As much as Osakowski's career has been up and down, it's been sort of tantalizing moments of promise, interspersed with just moments where you just wish he just, like, he must have led the league in shots that went in and out of the basket. As much as he's had these sort of up and down moments, he really played well in the NIT, and he deserves the praise that came to him for that.
So, taking a look out of this game, out of this tournament, some takeaways. What are we going to be seeing from this tournament next season, Tim?
Well, I hope the energy again. I mean, that's as Johnny said. If we don't incorporate anything else from now until next season, that's really the biggest thing I'd like to see is that the identity of a team that plays with that kind of hustle and that kind of movement on defense is really kind of what we hang our hat on, because I think Shaka has the kind of junkyard dog players in Ramey and Coleman, and hopefully even like a Liddell and like a Donovan Williams or Kai Jones coming up that can bring the versatility on defense, the quickness, the lateral quickness, the length to cause a lot of problems, because we've seen when we do have these pockets of games and we haven't had the 5-game stretch like we have in these, in the NIT. But when we do have those moments inside of our games, we're pretty doggone good. So we need to see that. I think that otherwise it's like a lot of college athletics. It's a question of, do we get the plays in the big moments that we need? You know, can we find a playmaker? You know, I think a lot of people believe, myself included, that Ramey's that guy. If he is that guy and we can count on him in big moments to come up with clutch shots, if we can count on him in big moments to, you know, to create really well for others, that kind of stuff, if he can ascend and be what we all kind of hope that Kerwin could be, then this team's going to have a chance to be super good. And I think that we got enough good stuff from him and from the other underclassmen in this tournament to feel good about ourselves. But look, to your point, Will, and I did a little bit with this a few minutes ago. So here is what Dylan averaged, and I was telling Johnny this before we get started. Here are Dylan's averages in the NIT. 53% overall from the floor, 45% from three, 75% from the foul line, 6.4 rebounds, 2 assists, 15.6 points. So in the 5 games, that's what he added. Here are Kerwin's numbers. 48% from the floor, 44% from 3, 56% from the foul line, not very good, 4.4 rebounds, 5 assists, 17 points. So on the one hand, you have that what we kind of know about Texas with Kerwin and Dylan, that they're very up and down, super inconsistent, good and bad, seemingly simultaneously. And then we look at that like, but yeah, Texas is going to have to replace 33 points, over 10 rebounds, 7 assists, and terrific shooting from when they have been kind of at their best over the last couple of years. Like if these 5 games is sort of Texas at their best, then we're going to have to replace that. And so, you know, it's going to be interesting because you know, there's plenty to look at of you know, so much better gameplay, some different offensive wrinkles that they brought in, some of their individual guys like putting up some really good numbers, and we still have some big questions. So, there's a blueprint that we can follow, but I'm interested to see how some of those decision making as far as personnel, how we do replace some of that production is gonna factor into next season.
I am less concerned about the offense than I have been going into an offseason in 3 years.
Well,
since
Isaiah was here. We'll get into questions about next year, but what do you think next year you're going to see from this tournament?
I would hope to see what we saw during the NIT. Like, it's pretty straightforward. Like, the offense was efficient. The defense was very high energy, like Tim said. Like, you can't exactly pick up where you left off when there's several months in between and several different players involved. But I'd like to see them, if they can put forth that sort of energy defensively, even if they're not executing quite as well, that will cover a lot of sins. And I think an offseason for Shaka and Neil Berry to work on new offensive wrinkles to highlight guys like Ramey and Febres and Andrew Jones, they could hit the full run.
All right, so let's go ahead and stop the tournament here and just try to summarize the certain season. Let's do a post-mortem on the season. In the obituary of Texas's 2018-2019 season, what are you putting in there? What are your general thoughts on the season?
I think that the tombstone says, I know it wasn't the NCAA, but it's a disappointing season. It's the disappointing season because they had the sort of inconsistency they had throughout the year. They lost a handful of games that were there for them to take. They ended up in the NIT instead of the NCAA. So yeah, it's absolutely a disappointing season. Having said that, it is good to see the way they responded to what I guess you would call the ultimate disappointment for a team of their caliber, or their supposed caliber, I guess. They're not actually that caliber if they didn't make the NCAA tournament. it's a disappointing year. I can't help but think that I am impressed with the way they responded to that disappointment and how they ended things. But yeah, disappointing is the adjective to use for the season. It's the easiest one, but it's also the correct one.
So, Tim, what about you, man? What does the tombstone say?
Yeah, I don't know, something about like a drunk that figures his shit out at the end of his life, or maybe like a prude who figures out that like being drunk is awesome. Or something like that. I don't know. Like, I think what made the last five
life, and then in the final year,
he had a great time those last five. what stood out to me about the NIT tournament was that it was decidedly not Texas this year. You know, we've been looking for these things, whether we're talking about consistency from Dylan and Kerwin, whether we're talking about, again, that defensive energy, whether we're talking about, like, whatever. Like, we've been looking for that for the, you know, for the first 32 games of the season. We were hoping for that. And we didn't get it. And then we got that five-game taste of it, right, of whatever yep. those things were. We got that. And so, you know, it's hard to – it's one of those reasons why – you know, it's so satisfying because it's not just that we won the NIT. That's nice. But we could have won and looked like ass, right? Like, you could probably beat some of these teams and not look all that great. And while I would, you know, I can remember it was the late 90s. Michigan had like their second Fab Five class, but there was the first Fab Five class with like Weber and Jordan and Weber and Howard and Rose and Jackson and King. And then they had they had a second Fab Five class that was super highly ranked, and like Maurice Taylor and Gerard Ward, and they did almost nothing. Like, I don't think they won any NCAA tournament games, or at least like maybe one. And they had like Robert Tractor Trailer, if you remember that guy, and Lewis Bullock. And they won the NIT tournament too. And I remember people were like, well, actually, I think if Michigan had made the NCAAs, they'd be an Elite Eight team. and you know, when I look at Texas like this, like I don't fall into that shit. Like I don't find myself thinking those same like delusions with that. But I do sort of look at it and wonder, okay, well, if Kansas played Colorado, or if Texas Tech played Colorado, would they have beaten them in the same way that we did? Like, no, like, it's not a huge feat to beat Colorado, but we shit on them. No, it's not a big feat to beat TCU, but we beat them easily. You know what I mean? So, a good team would have beaten those teams in, I think, a very comparable way to the fact that, to how we beat them. So I don't come off of those wins and say, yep, see, there you go. That's going to prove that we're decent. But I do look at that and say, okay, that was a performance that looks like how a good team would look. And that's for me is very satisfying, because I've thought for a while, hey, we've got the horses to do it. Clearly he's recruiting on a level that I think is going to get us there. Clearly I believe he's got the X's and O's chops to figure this out. There's just something missing. And for these five games, it sure looked like what I think a good team should look like against that caliber of opponents. Because we didn't have a close game. I mean, Xavier was close. Otherwise, we rolled the last three games, I would say.
Yeah, I think, and correct me if I'm wrong here, if I'm going to give a grade to this season, I'm thinking B- and just barely getting to that B-. Like, you got an 80 on the test because you somehow guessed the right few answers correct. Because
no, I mean, like even though it's the NIT, like you have to say that was a you know, like a 95 or 100% on the test. Like, I mean, they still aced the test.
No, but because the entire season is the test. I'm looking at grading the entire season here. Winning the NIT, okay, great. I'm still giving you a B- here, because while you did have some wins against UNC, you beat Purdue, you also lost to Radford, you lost to Oklahoma State, you lost to Providence, you lost to VCU, and even though VCU was a decent team, that's where you took the guy for that currently coaches your team. You're supposed to beat that team. You lost to Baylor after you had a 19-point lead. You blew it against TCU twice. There were so many points in the season where, yeah, they had some great moments, but they also had some super lows, and that's why I can't give you an A on this test. You are a B-, and only
so
because
you're saying the
ended off really well.
So you're saying the entire season is the test, as opposed to saying the entire season is like the semester of the class or whatever.
Yeah, so then, yeah.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah, if the entire season is a semester, then sure, I guess you did great on the final.
On the final.
But right. If the final is like 20% of the grade, then you still got a B minus on the test.
I like to think of this as someone in the 3-point shooting contest who only hits about 5 of the regular shots, but gets all 5 of the money balls.
Right.
This is sort of, yeah. The NIT was the money balls. And so, then you know, they come out with, what is it, like 15 points at that point because they hit all the 2-point money ball shots. I mean, if we're putting grades, like, yeah, this is, you know, the season is a C-, but you hit the extra credit at the end to bring it up. Like,
right,
that's,
exactly.
It was a disappointing season.
You were the definition of average. 16-16 with some good wins and some bad losses. Like,
yeah, I mean, they were very average, high major team, but the NIT, they did, they really shine for whatever reason, and we will see next year if that was sustainable or if that was a dead cat bounce.
Tim is not in agreement.
Yeah, the teacher in me totally disagree. So I'm just, but I think that's obviously a context of being a teacher that has nothing to do with this argument in particular. So,
well, as someone who hasn't taken a test in like 20 years, you are wrong.
Well, I would just say they were average from the standpoint of like what a Power 5 team should be, right? So like 16-16 in the Big 12 is right, but to me they were way below average for what their ceiling was. Like I would say that the season was a D minus or you know maybe like a high F from that standpoint. Like good, like you know some really good things, but like it was bad enough that I would say if they, let's say they lose in the first round to South Dakota State, like I'm pretty comfortably, like the highest I would go from that standpoint would be a D minus. So the highest I would go from now would be, you know, not anywhere close to a B minus. Anyway, sorry.
So you're going, we're getting into lower, grading stuff. You're going like they have a C.
Yeah. I mean, I'm yeah. Like it's, yeah.
They got a C because of the final. Right. Like, otherwise, yes. They were going to get like a D. Yeah.
Right.
I can see that. That's, I can definitely see that. That is a valid argument.
That's fair.
That's I feel like both are valid arguments, but
semantics. Sorry.
Semantics. No. And I also want to know, what were y'all's favorite and least favorite parts of the season?
Boy, least favorite for me was probably a tie between the Providence loss and the TCU loss at home. Best part was, I still think the UNC game, because like just the hope and the promise of being 5-0 and beating North Carolina, like that 18 hours of euphoria was pretty great until
the
second half against
Michigan State. Game.
The well,
Michigan
no,
State.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Yeah, that was pretty magical, and then. And then she came on crashing down. Came crashing down. So.
Yeah, it's I mean, I guess if we're just like the sort of the traditional highest point would probably be the UNC game. I did really enjoy the Kansas State game. I like the Grand Canyon game for entirely different reasons, just because it was sort of, you know, crazy ass basketball that was and Texas just went ballistic on them. So like maybe the best way to sum up the season is the game at Lawrence. Is you had this sort of high of how they came back. Like they, you know, they were the first few minutes of that game were it was looking bad, and then they really kicked it into gear, and they got up on Kansas, and they had that fucking Febres miss dunk at halftime that was just, you were like, you know, missed the, you know, that dunk, does that missed dunk haunt you? And then they just keep hanging with Kansas, and they come back and they got a chance to win at the end, and they fucked that last play up so badly. Roach just fucked that place. That is going to be 40 years from now. Someone is going to ask me about Kerwin Roach, and I'm going to think of that play first. That is going to be the first play. Like,
and that is why that game is my low point of this season. It was just like Radford, you felt bad afterwards, but Kansas is like, you had hope, and then it was just crushed.
And yeah, the play they wanted, too. The play they wanted.
He had space. Yeah, it was the perfect. It was sort of the perfect synopsis of this season, of this sort of roller coaster of emotions, of momentary highs and momentary lows, and you know, this sort of sense of you see this team being so close to what it can be, but they don't get there, and so.
And they don't get there for a comical, ridiculous reason.
Yes. So that, I mean, it doesn't really answer your question, I guess. I mean, if we're going back to, you know, sort of highest, lowest for me is probably the Georgia game. Because that was just, was just a debacle. I guess maybe I don't want to say the Iowa State win in Austin was the highest, partly because I didn't see it live, but it felt like, oh, all right, maybe they got it fixed enough. They're going to make a tournament, and then they just, you know, eat shit the next two games, and it's I'll go with the Kansas game because it does feel like a good summary of the year, but yeah, I'll say low is Georgia, high is either UNC or that Iowa State game at home.
So let's go ahead and get on to second to last thing and still post-mortem of the season. Shaka Smart, what did he not do this year?
I don't want to say he forgot to teach defense. That's not exactly right. But it's, you know, one of the things that we've heard repeatedly over the first, you know, three-ish years from Shaka's tenure, and honestly, it's an extension of the last few years of Barnes, was that why can't they shoot? Why can't they play offense? Why, you know, Shaka needs to hire an offensive assistant. Well, he did. That's what Neil Barry was, and he came in and did a lot of good things. And it's not a coincidence that Texas had one of their most efficient offenses in the last decade. So one thing he did do was that. However, it doesn't seem like I don't feel like it's a question of Shaka not reaching the players. I don't think it's a question of them tuning him out, because clearly from the NIT, they're still listening, they're still bought in. There has to be some way to bridge that last little gap. Because when you look at the way Texas played more, you know, off and on throughout the season, you look at how close they were to being in the top third of the conference, but they weren't. What he didn't do is he didn't solve that gap. He has not successfully solved that gap from most, if not all, of his Texas tenure. And that is the gap that takes a program from being a competitive program to a top program. And he hasn't done that yet. So, if he doesn't solve that gap, he's not going to make it much longer at Texas. So, that's the thing he hasn't done, in my opinion. He's not figured out the variable or variables that allow him to bridge that gap.
Very well put. I think that when he comes to Austin, I think the hope and promise that came with him was this exciting brand of basketball, where we've got a coach that can relate to young people, that is already very good, that kind of has figured out how his style of basketball can work against even the best teams in the country. And it didn't really happen. I mean, it has in spurts, and that's nice. But it, you know, I don't think anyone would look at his tenure in Austin and say, yep, this is what we thought or hoped for. Clearly, no one would say that. But I also think that he has an opportunity here to kind of, I don't want to say reinvent himself as the Texas coach, but certainly reinvent the narrative around his team, where people look at them and say, you know what, they do play hard, and they do play for each other, and they do exhibit this this mindset that he's been talking about. Like, you know, when people poo-poo the SEAL team training and stuff like that, like, well, they're not actually fucking tough. And you know, it's hard to argue that. But I think that
Wait,
all
it's hard
that
to argue
stuff,
that SEALs aren't tough?
No, well, it's hard to argue that Texas is not very tough, right? Yeah.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah.
You assumed I was going to say the SEAL team was not tough. That's pretty ridiculous.
Well, you know, that's usually where your conversations go about the fourth whiskey in. So
I can. You know what I hate about the SEALs?
Let me tell you, I'm Green Beret all the way. We got a hot take over here. But you know, Shaka would be the first person to admit that the answers have not come inside the time frame that he wanted them to. And I think that for as far as like what needs to go on into next season is we need to, more so than finding a player that can hit big shots, more so than, you know, figuring out exactly how we can get rebounds, more so than creating more steals or generating whatever havoc it's going to be. Like, we need to play with a mindset of we are going to try really, really hard all the time. We're not going to fall prey to this idea that, hey, we are Texas, and because we are Texas, we, you know, are entitled to this or that or whatever. And I do think there's a semblance of that he has either miscalculated or you know, was unable to sort of expect or whatever. And I hope that these five games, and as we move into next season, that this is our step in that direction.
Yeah, I mean, I think when people talk about toughness, I feel like a lot of it is bullshit, frankly. I think what people think of as toughness is really experience. And I think that the teams that exhibit quote-unquote toughness usually happen to be teams with a lot of upperclassmen, teams with a lot of players with experience. And Texas has not had that reliably for, I don't know, a decade for the most part, you know, other than that last Isaiah Taylor year. They haven't had an older team. And Shaka's teams have not been older teams for the most part. I think they are slowly trending that way to older and more experienced. And I think you might see a more quote unquote tough team in that it's experience for the most part. I mean, you know, maybe the Army team is actually super tough because they're fucking Army players, you know, but yeah, I feel like changing the narrative with Shaka is going to take a lot of time. I don't think any one season will do it short of a national championship run type situation. But I think it's possible that this next year could be the inflection point that moves things in the right direction. That he's finally able to overcome some of the issues with his first recruiting class or two, and sort of the attrition rate of those, where he's finally starting to be able to build a pipeline, as it were. And that might manifest itself in very positive ways next year, but it's still very unknown. But if he's going to do it, next year is going to have to be the year.
And I wonder if we'll look back in 6 years or 10 years and say, Ramey was the catalyst for that.
He could be the Javon Carter of this team.
Yeah, that he was the guy where Shaka kind of figured it out. Like, all right, this is a guy who simultaneously got the skills to be a very high level Power 5 conference dude, and he's a fucking douchebag who wants to slit your throat at any moment, right? Which is sort of what he had at VCU, of like these guys who were maybe under the radar and really, really wanted to win super bad all the time and had that kind of junkyard dog mentality. But at Texas, that's tough to get. Like, who's the last guy that had a junkyard dog mentality at Texas?
Home,
like, people
maybe?
Would talk. Yeah, maybe. I mean, but even then, like, I don't know. Like, he was kind of a finesse player. Like, you know, the few moments when he actually was very physical were kind of surprising, as opposed to, like, he spent a lot of time.
Yeah, I was just thinking more in terms of attitude.
But even then, like the anyway. So yes, it's gonna be interesting to see how well if Ramey ends up being the guy. And I'd hope that it would be Coleman, right? I, obviously, I spend a lot of time on this podcast talking about how much I really respect Matt and think he's got a chance to be very good. But everyone talks about how nice he is and how polite he is and how conscientious he is of his teammates. And it sort of looks like Ramey is like, fuck my teammate. I'll scream at anybody anytime. I'll yell at coach right now if I have to. And maybe that is the exact fuck mindset everybody. That – right, yeah, exactly. Like, oh, I'll shit on your face. Like, whatever. Like, it doesn't make any difference.
Okay.
You know?
Ramey
seems like he's got a little Charles Oakley in him. And I mean that in the best possible way.
Yeah,
like, he seems like a dude that if you had Matt Coleman and Ramey in an alley and you decided you wanted to mug one of them, you're 100% going after Coleman, right?
Like, oh, yeah, of course.
Like, because Ramey probably already brought his own knife out. Like,
Ramey saw you go into the alley and followed you in with a knife.
Yeah.
He stabbed Coleman so that you were surprised when Coleman was already stabbed, and then he stabbed you.
Right.
You go to stab Coleman, and you're like, what? And then, boom, right in the kidney.
As much as I like guys like Coleman and Hayes and, you know, Roach, who are just these sort of like, they're very gregarious, friendly sort of, you know, that they've got these nice personalities. This team needs a couple mean motherfuckers. And Ramey is 100% that dude. Like, there is, if you gave me Ramey versus the entire rest of the team on who gets the most technicals this year, I'm betting Ramey. Like, he will equal the rest of the team because he is already pretty much equaled the rest of the team this year, and he didn't even play that much. So I'm pretty sure he's going to lead the conference in double technicals. I feel like that's a pretty safe bet.
So give me your questions heading into next year. What are some of the biggest questions next year that need to be answered in your mind?
So my first question is, this may not be the most important, but this is the first one that I came up with, was, is Jay Lucas here next year? And if he's not, who is Shaka replacing him with? I'm less concerned about the recruiting angle of it as I am. Does Shaka take this opportunity to bring in someone who is, sort of a well-known tactician? Does he take this time to pick somebody who, you know, really knows how to bring out the best in guards? Like, there's an opportunity here if Jay moves on. And if Jay stays, does he bring something more to the table to help push this team to the next level? The second one, and this one's probably more important in all honesty, is who transfers? I expect one transfer, maybe two. And it's, you know, it's not, nobody has to transfer for the numbers to work, assuming Jackson Hayes goes pro, which seems extremely likely. But it'll be interesting to see who decides to move on, because then you might start to get, one, some idea of who's going to take up time next year, who's picking up minutes next year. Two, if you see more than one or two, then maybe that's a signal that something, there's a house cleaning going on, or things are not as copacetic as they seem in the locker room. So that's something to, you know, if we're trying to read tea leaves, who stays and who goes is definitely probably the bigger one.
I guess my two questions, the first would be, what does the future hold for Andrew Jones? Because I think that they're, in whatever the multiverse is out there in existence, if there is a universe where Andrew is close to 100%, or even close to like 80% or 85%, he drastically changes the fortunes of this program and team. I really think so. I really believe in him as a player. So that will be a big question mark for me.
What if we're in the Spider Pig universe? Is that...
I'm right here. That movie was wonderful, by the way. My other question is, how does this roster stuff figure out as far as their personnel decisions? because I really felt like there were a number of minutes in the NIT, maybe unsurprisingly, where we looked at our best when we went four small, one big. You know, whether it was Sims on the interior or Osetkowski on the interior, where you had a lineup of Coleman, Ramey, Febris, Roach, Sims, or Coleman, Ramey, Febris, Roach, Osetkowski. And we were flying around, and we got good rebounding from our guards, and we just seemed to attack ball screens much more capably than we had at other parts of the season. And I liked how we looked with that small ball lineup. But Hepa, who I think is going to be back, what if Hepa is still here? Where does he fit in that role? Baker, where does he fit in that role? Kai Jones, where does he fit in that role? You know, and I think, you know, Sims, where does he fit in that role? Like, if we have these four capable big guys, it sure seemed like we had five straight games of us looking very good with that type of lineup. How does Shaka figure out his minute allotment, his personnel decisions as far as like who's going to play with whom, that kind of stuff, when on the one hand we looked really good with this personnel grouping, but we also have these other recruits and these other players on our roster that maybe suggest we can play bigger. So like how does he make those decisions? That'll be good, because we, again, you know, as much as this season was or felt like a must win, I guess next year is even more so, because on the one hand the NIT run was great, on the other hand, like,
which means CBI champions.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and last year Mississippi State made to the NIT semifinals, and then they were a five seed this year in the tournament. So like there's lots of things, and who knows, like maybe this, you know, maybe Texas breaks the mold and makes the Sweet 16 next year. Like, it's, nothing is out of the realm of possibilities, but it, you know, there's some of that stuff where like there's still some big questions left for Shaka to answer.
Right. And I think another question will be, and I think we kind of answer this, is whose team is this next year? Ramey's. But how do you deal with the loss of Roach and Osetkowski after what we saw in that tournament? Did y'all already say that?
We talked about it some. Yeah, some, just like from their production standpoint of what they were able to do. But I think it bears repeating, honestly, because they were so good. I mean, they were so good. If we had gotten those two guys, as much as Johnny said, hey, if we had had that kind of energy the rest of the time, if we had played defensively the rest of the year like we did in the NIT, we would be this good. Well, if they had produced like that the rest of the year, we'd have been that good too.
I'm not concerned about how those two get replaced. I don't mean to like shit on them that hard. It's just with who is coming in, I feel fairly secure that the their production will be replaced, at least in aggregate, if not by someone stepping up.
And here's my response to that is, I think it's the Chris Boyd effect, where if we're going to pretend we're football, let's go ahead and pretend that Curran Roach is Chris Boyd, where Chris Boyd had so many huge bluffs that were very, very visible, but also he was kind of important. Same thing with Courtney Ramey, where he had so many huge bluffs, but maybe he was pretty important to some degree in some games and had some big moments. Same thing with Dylan Osetkowski.
Yeah, Roach is definitely important. He is, you know, there's two sides of the same coin of, there were some moments that were not possible without him, but there were also some moments on the downside that were not possible without him. He was very much a high risk, high reward kind of guy. Osetkowski a little less so. He was, you know, he had less variability. I guess it just, to me, it doesn't feel like, you know, for example, Hepa and Will Baker could not potentially pick up the slack of what Osetkowski did. And it also feels like, if Roach, with Roach gone, a healthy Andrew Jones and Ramey and Coleman and Jace, like those guys can all pick up those pieces to me reasonably well. Like we saw Febres attacking the fucking paint in the NIT. Like he's got something in there. And if Jones comes back as healthy as I believe he will, that's a fringe NBA guy who just showed up on your doorstep shooting 45% from three and with the ability to get to the rim. So like, It's not so much that I think those guys, I don't think those guys were worthless or terrible or anything like that. It's just, I don't think they were so singularly gifted that it's impossible to replace the production that they provided.
We still have to do it, but I agree with you. But we still have to do it. Yep. So, yeah, yep. I don't want to minimize what they were able to do, but I think Johnny's right that we can reproduce it, but they have to. So
yeah. Right. Well, I think we're going to have to end it off there, y'all, and that'll be the third season, I believe, unless I'm miscounting, which would be very embarrassing for the last show, but also very on brand of...
Pretend your one shining moment of next season is forgetting how many years we've been doing this.
Yeah. Well, thank y'all for pretending we were football for an entire basketball season. I have been your host, Will Baizer. You guys can find me on Twitter at WILLBAIZER. But the main stars of the show, we'll start off with Johnny Brashear. Johnny Brashear, my man, where can we find you?
I'm on Twitter, Instagram, Discord at Bitter White Guy. Also Reddit, actually. Yes, yeah. I'm also there. Yeah.
And Johnny, our new favorite little tradition we do at the end of every show starting this year, where in the world is Mr. Timothy Preston?
He is actually in my warm, loving embrace right now.
1, 2, 3.
I didn't know what to sing. I was coming up with a bunch of different songs, but I couldn't think of one. You can find me on InsideTexas.com. We have an awesome community. Great basketball minds there. We'd love to have you. Also wonderful football content. So come check out InsideTexas.com or on Twitter at InsideTexasHoop, no S. It still flabbergasts me that there are people around the country that care enough to listen to what three guys like us want to say about college basketball, particularly Texas. Well,
the region. Let's not get too overly broad here.
Like, wherever they are, I'm so grateful. And it's not lost on me that, like, you know, the feedback has been so positive, even though we are so shitty. Yeah. So thank you for being kind and thoughtful with us. We hope that you enjoy it as much as we have fun together.
Yes, thank you for feeding our delusions of grandeur. We appreciate it.
Right. Thank you for being Johnny's delusions of grandeur.
Yeah, right. It's just mine.
Y'all make this show fun to do. Y'all listening to it, y'all's feedback, y'all's enjoyment of the show make it enjoyable for us. That's not true. We would do this whether or not you enjoyed it, so... You know what?
It would just be shorter.
Yeah, exactly. I would make less money on it than the $0 I make on it now.
Our compulsion actually turned out to be popular. It's sort of a happy accident.
Yeah, if anyone is interested in going ahead and subsidizing Pretend We're Football for the next year, please do so. That would be awesome.
That would be great.
Yeah, Tim could finally afford the S on his handle.
Yeah.
I'm now hoops. It's now hoops.
It would be a money sign.
Yeah, it's a dollar sign.
But Tim, for those who are missing you over the off season and want to find you on the basketball court, where could they find you?
Yeah. Well, there's three places of varying degrees of comfort. I'm most comfortable outside shooting the rock from the perimeter. But really where I have the most comfort is inside with the big boys. But I think if pressed, I would say, yeah, the place where comfort is most obvious for me is right in your fucking face.
Right in your fucking face.
Mm-hmm.
Right in your fucking face. And for those who want to find us in our previous shows and our other shows, go ahead and subscribe to Hornscast. That's the Hornscast channel on iTunes, Podbean, Google Play, Spotify. Anywhere you guys can find a podcast, you'll find the Hornscast. On that note, thank y'all for listening. We will see y'all next season. Hook 'em.
My Johnny? Daughter, each morning when Johnny? We wake up, she asks for Carnation Instant Breakfast. It's just vanilla. And, you know, if it was chocolate, I could respect her, but it's just vanilla, so it's a little bit tougher because vanilla, you know, it's a good thing, but it's not wonderful. But she likes that. She's been big into My Little Ponies lately. So the problem is My Little Pony for that, you know, she's five, but it's only like 6 or 7 seasons, and it's all the goddamn same thing. The songs are terrible, and the storylines are about friendship, which I appreciate. You know, friendship is important. But it's also kind of dumb, and it's like a magical element that's really kind of stupid. Plus, some of the ponies are like mean to each other. Like, they're not even kind. They, for the most part, they kind of like, you know, do whatever they want to do, and then they realize, like, oh, I'm a bad friend. You know, and I think that when you're talking about bad friendship, there are some things that I really don't like. One of them is blueberries. Blueberries are so frustrating.
So frustrating.